your identity is also relationship. Like, I have a relationship to my South Asian-ness, to my Muslimness, to my queerness that's ever evolving and ever growing and changing in different moments. And it's not a thing that I think can ever be just one thing or fixed in a kind of way that I think sometimes we're taught identity is.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Fatima Oscar, author of When We Were Sisters. It's a novel that traces an intense bond of three orphaned siblings who, after their parents die, are left to raise one another. As Bindu Bansanath writes of the book, there is no idealism in When We Were Sisters. Shared trauma disintegrates relationships as much as it strengthens them. Monsters aren't just monsters, they are subject to demons of their own. Fatima Oscar is the author of If They Come For Us and When We Were Sisters. Fatima is a poet, a filmmaker, educator, and performer. They are the writer and co-creator of Brown Girls, an Emmy-nominated web series that highlights friendships between women of color. They are also a co-editor of Halal If You Hear Me, an anthology that celebrates Muslim writers who are also women, queer, gender non-conforming, and or trans. Fatima, welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you for having me.
In a Q&A in New York Magazine's The Cut, Bindu Bansanath writes of your novel, "No structure, even among siblings, is fixed." And the unfixed nature of identity of your characters is something that really, at least to my reading, really drives your novel's narrative. It's mentioned over and over, especially as that fluidity has to do with family. You write in one such moment, "We're brothers or sisters or mothers or something in between." Fatima, what's the relationship between gender, identity, and genre in your work, both in this book and outside of it?
Yeah, that's such a beautifully phrased question. And I think about genre as being something that is very fluid. Like, I've never been one to be very fixed in something. And I think even about, like the kind of genre more as being like a guide map, but you're kind of just like allowing whatever needs to come forth and kind of playing and being experimental in that space. And I think that that's also a really big way that I think of so many aspects of like my identity. Like I think there's no way that I think of identity as a fixed point. Like, it's always a journey, and there's always a way that you're going and a thing that you're exploring for every single human being. And so in the same way, like, when I think about genre, I'm in a relationship to genre. And so with poetry, I think I've probably been in relationship to poetry for about 15 years. So it's quite a long love of mine. But then there are moments like you would have with someone that you've been with for 15 years where you're like, "You're annoying me and I like don't want to be with you right now." And like, I don't really want to do this thing right now, you know? And then there's kind of some newer genres that just take hold of me, and I'm so enamored by them, but I'm also very new at them. So I'm kind of fumbling, you know, and still getting to learn their bodies and getting to learn them a little bit. And so I think that there's kind of a way in which every time I think about genre, I think about that, like, it's all relationship. Your identity is also relationship. Like, I have a relationship to my South Asian-ness, to my Muslimness, to my queerness that's ever evolving and ever growing and changing in different moments. And it's not a thing that I think can ever be just one thing or fixed in a kind of way that I think sometimes we're taught identity as.
So then how do you think about the different genres that you've written in or between or around when it comes to fulfillment as an artist? You wrote the web series Brown Girls and were a producer and writer on Miss Marvel. You have this book of poetry, If They Come For Us. Mm. How do they fulfill you in different ways? I imagine that your feeling surrounding each book or each project could be quite different.
Yeah, I mean, my feeling regarding every single project is different, and regarding every single iteration of each project is different. And I think that it's less about, it really comes when the question is there, when it's like, I need to answer this question, or I need to sit in this question for a bit. And, you know, with so much of art making and genre, it just feels like it's about play. And it's about, like, can I play in this thing that's exciting me? Can I play in this question? Can I play with my collaborators? Are these the collaborators that I want to play with right now? Is there kind of a way that we can kind of embark on a journey of answering some of these questions together? Satisfaction comes from the exploration of the question. It comes from the making and the remaking. And it comes from also, sometimes it comes from doing a thing that, you know, you're like, wow, I didn't know how much I needed this, and I didn't know that that was possible. Like, I think about, for example, with Miss Marvel, getting partition on a Disney show. Like, that was pretty, that was our Trojan horse. Like, we knew we were doing it. We knew that's what we were doing from the beginning. And to really, really kind of, you know, go through that process and get that there, where people were, you know, talking about, like, I never knew about this before, and now I know about this and stuff like that. Like, that was a very humbling moment. And it was a moment of like, oh, right, this is why we were doing that thing. This is why we came and we, like, worked on this project every day. And the kind of satisfaction of this is so vastly different. And that's a completely different satisfaction than writing a book that's completely my own, you know, and has so many other things that are kind of at stake.
I want listeners to understand sort of the context that we've been talking within. You mentioned the word partition. We're talking about the separation of British India into India and Pakistan.
Yeah. So, yeah, partition occurred in 1947 when colonial Britain left South Asia and left it in quite a state of disarray, had been colonizing the continent for at least 100 years, if not longer, and really, really exploitative practices and, meddling in terms of religious and ethnic-based differences, and then kind of left this big continent, you know, that had always previously been under many different rulerships and left it. And what occurred was one of the biggest atrocities in the last 100 years, and it had, I think, 14 million refugees were displaced on either. So it was it partitioned into India and East and West Pakistan, which is now Pakistan and Bangladesh, and Kashmir. And so the partition left about 14 million refugees, with about 2 to 3 million people murdered. And I think 100,000, at least 100,000 women abducted and raped. And so we're talking about really, really massive violence that occurred in the span of a couple of months and then continued, the echoes of which continued forward. And including now, you know, we see a lot of religious-based violence across the continent of South Asia that has, if not roots, at least quite a big anchor in partition.
Partition does play a role in When We Were Sisters, especially in relationship to these children, their uncle, right? We learned that was a huge part of his history. But boundaries and borders, maybe broadly or generally, are sort of an intrinsic part of this story. There are boundaries between people, between nations, as we're talking about in partition, you know, skin as a boundary or border. How do you consider boundaries, or how did you consider boundaries when approaching this particular work?
Yeah, I think that this book has so many, I think that's a really beautiful observation. I think that this book, there's so much around boundaries and borders that kind of exists within the characters. And I think is a trauma response based off of what the elder generation of these characters have experienced in their life, and then the way that they kind of enact that on the young folks that they're around, and then the way that those kids internalize that, even when they're living in a different place than, you know, their family might have been living, in South Asia. But that kind of thing of the trauma that you carry with you, and then also the incredible trauma of America and the borders in America that are put on, and also the ideas of, like, what is acceptable or what is the considered quote unquote normal human in America and what isn't, you know, and whose experience is marginalized and not. But I think that there is a lot of isolation and separation in the book. And, you know, there's even the way in that which that uncle character, like, he kind of erects in his own pain and grief, kind of erects like this little fortress around himself. And it's very hard to permeate that. It's the level of walls that are up are just kind of impossible to get through. And then he's also enacting that onto the kids, you know, not only, and there's this one moment where Kosa is riffing in the when she's quite young and she's talking about, oh my, you know, like I'm his kid. He calls me his kid. But like, you know, he doesn't live in the same place with me. And yet he also doesn't live in the same place with his sons. And those are his sons. And so therefore I must be his kid. Like that kind of thing of like, what does love look like to a person that has that much distancing around them? Then they're kind of only able to love in a certain way. They're only able to really love with a border between them and someone else. And you can accept it or you cannot. You know, you can say like, that's not fair. You can be like, this is the way that this person... This is the way that this person's trauma has impacted them and made them able to love, and the ways in which they're able to mitigate that. And so I think that the characters are kind of always navigating these unseen borders between themselves and the unspoken borders too between themselves and the other characters in the book.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Fatima Oscar. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. If you want to listen to this conversation again or share it with friends, it can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I want to talk about the uncle because, as we've been talking about, he is the person who takes these children, these sisters, brothers, mothers, in when they are orphaned, when their father dies. And in the book, you've redacted the uncle's name. It's uncle, and then there's black space, leaving these kind of black marks on the pages. What was behind that decision to redact his name? And for me, like, that's both like a subjective question, like a topical question, but it's also like an aesthetic question, you know, what you were thinking about when you were leaving these black marks on the page, how you wanted those black marks to be considered by the readers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this book is very concerned. It's a very aesthetically concerned book. Like, you know, there's a lot of visualness on the page. There's a lot of things that go on that I think people wouldn't kind of normally associate with a novel, but is very endemic to my work, I think. In terms of that, the redaction, I mean, his name was redacted from the beginning. Like it was always kind of redacted. It was a thing that it just felt very intuitive to do, and it felt like very right. And I was just like, yeah, like this feels like this needs to be redacted and stuff. And kind of, I think that the marking of the page, that kind of mark, that little vortex of the redaction is quite violent. You know, it's quite a violent thing to look at. And I think that the fact that the whole book is just kind of covered in that redaction every time that Kosar alludes to, you know, this uncle that is their legal guardian and around a lot, kind of conveys the sense of fear and the sense of omnipresence of like fear and inability to talk and silencing and harm that I think, you know, is lingering on Kosar and their siblings in the aftermath of being raised in this family and being raised in this way. And so that was one of the reasons. I mean, another one was I just really wanted it to not feel far away. And I think sometimes when you create a character in a book, you know, and there's a name, you can kind of, people can outsource the name or can kind of be like, oh yeah, it's like kind of like a villainous, especially on a villainous character, like can it kind of outsource that as like not being very close or kind of being something that was made up. And there's something about the redaction that actually makes it feel like it's not made up, like it's quite close to the reader, which I think was very important for me. And then I think the last reason was that from an audience perspective, I wanted the audience to autopilot that name with whoever they thought of. And I think that there's kind of a way where, you know, many people I've spoken to have been like, yep, I definitely had a name that came into my head when I was reading and I saw that redaction. And I think even on the flip side of that, you know, what you get is, because people often ask me about the uncle, but then they don't ask me about the brackets around the father's name. And I think that because they have such different responses, you know, it's like the father's name, the brackets, it's absence. You're getting a connotation, you're getting this kind of feeling of absence and the perpetual absence of this death and what happened. But it's not an absence that feels frightening. It's an absence that feels like an abyss and like kind of like almost even a wonder, because there's so much space and there's so much like what exists within that space. Whereas with the redaction is so inherently violent that it has a counter response to it, you know? And so the brackets and the redaction were also something that were kind of going in tandem in the creation of the book.
How would you speak to those ideas as they relate to safety? There's a moment in the book where Kosar says something like a certain kind of safe or a kind of safe. And it's a moment that stuck with me, because I think that in general, reading the book, I was very concerned for these children's safety throughout the entire book. Even as they were growing and kind of coming into their own agency, I was constantly concerned with their safety. So when it comes to these aesthetic choices like brackets or redactions, what would you say about safety as they have to do with that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think just even your observation of like being like, you know, as the experience of reading the book and being like, these kids are not safe and I'm like afraid for them. These kids are not safe, and they're not safe when they're adults either. Like, even though they're older and like capable of taking care of themselves, there's just they're kind of always existing in a space of dissafety. And something that I think about, and I think about having occupied my own body, and I think about, you know, a lot of my friends and their experiences and loved ones and their experiences when they talk, is like, safety is such an illusion. Like, I don't really know that safety fully, I don't know that safety really exists. And I think that you can feel safe with people, like there can be moments of safety with people, but I don't know that there is like static safety. And I think if there is static safety, it's probably the people who feel that way are probably extremely privileged in this world, in a certain society. But when you don't have that, you're really vulnerable kind of all the time. Like there's a certain kind of vulnerability that you walk with and you occupy, even when you're dissociated from it. And there's a lot of dissociation that you have to kind of inhabit in order to just be able to move through the world in certain bodies. And I think with this character, there really isn't really a time in there's very few times in their life where you can feel that they're safe. And those moments are usually in these kind of fleeting moments when they're with their sisters and they're, you know, they're going on these little joy rides or they're doing these little things together and they're having these moments. And then there's kind of some moments of safety with Bobby. You know, there's some moments of what Kosar, I think, is confusing as love with Bobby, and this kind of thing of that refrain of, can you make it last? Can you make this feeling last? There's such a deep hunger for safety, and then also such a deep denial of it. You know, like even in the character of Bobby, what you're getting is like these moments of love and adoration, and then also these kind of moments of violence, you know, and these moments of questionable consent that's happening and questionable things that are going on in their relationship. And so, I think that in terms of the question of safety, I think that this book is very concerned with safety. And I think what it does too is it's kind of like you're just looking at the fact that these characters might never be safe, but what they can find is safety in a moment, or safety with a certain person in a certain slowed down reverie, but that doesn't really exist for them in the world outside of that.
This isn't a formed question, but it's a question that I often have just, you know, in my mind when I'm reading stories of trauma. I often think of the writer and how they kept themselves safe during the writing, because I imagine it was somewhat of a difficult, but even, you know, further traumatic experience to relive and kind of dive into the traumas that your characters are experiencing. So I'm wondering how you kept yourself safe when, and I should note this for listeners, in the back of the book, you note that you wrote this book during a period of intense isolation. So I'm wondering, Fatima, how you kept yourself safe while you wrote this book.
You know, that's a great question. There wasn't, you know, in the same way, there wasn't really a lot of safety within the creation of this book. Like, I don't really think I knew what I was getting fully into when I started to write this book. And something that, like, you know, when you write fiction, like, you really do have to feel what your characters are feeling. So you feel kind of every experience that they're having. And, you know, a lot of that is, the bulk of that is through Gosar, but there's also moments in which you have to step, I had to step into like the uncle's point of view, or I had to step into, you know, other characters, Bobby's point of view, other characters' point of views, in order to not just make these characters like monstrous, you know, but to just be like, what is actually going on in their head as they're enacting some of these things, or they're doing some of these things, and what does this look like? And, you know, that's it's quite difficult to do work like that, because it challenges your narratives, it challenges your assumptions, it grows your empathy, it adds a lot of acceptance and a lot of forgiveness for just things in the world that you see. But it's not, and I can't stress this enough, but creating art is not a safe process. Like, it's just not. And there are things that you can do that you can create safety around. So there's like, you know, it's like you can, like, therapy or meditation or plant medicine or relying, like, calling up friends. Like, there's so many writers that I called where I was like, yo, you do not know me and I need your help. Like, can you help me? And it was, and they all came through to help, every single one that I reached out to. And I think it was that thing of knowing that all writers and artists, I think, to a certain extent, having this kind of experience of being like, yeah, the things that we're making, they're on the edge of a lot for us, you know? It's quite a vulnerable thing to be in an act of creation. And so you need help and you need support. And sometimes that support only comes through people who've had a similar experience, you know, and are complete strangers, but will call you up on the phone and like spend an hour or 2 hours talking to you. And then you have a really intense relationship with them the rest of your life after, because you're like, yeah, you held me down. But I think something I did was I just shut off a lot. So you know, I really, like, I deactivated all of my social media while I was writing this. I really kind of went into very intense hermit mode. People didn't hear from me for a really long time, and I'm quite a social person. And so, you know, kind of having that level of isolation because I needed to, because the work demanded it and called for it, was in a lot of ways a way of protecting myself as I was going through this.
You used the word monstrous earlier when you were talking about empathizing with your characters, or creating characters that your readers can empathize with. And that word monster appears often as a word Gosar attaches to their multiple selves and to their siblings. And I'm wondering how you approached that word in the crafting phase of this book. Is monster purely a signifier of discomfort or otherness in this novel, or are you trying to unpack something else with that word, especially as these children are placed in proximity to some really awful people, like uncle, or circumstances?
I think that there's a way in which when we really think of folks as monsters, they become unhuman. And there becomes a way where we're not able to engage with anything around them. So the memory of them, the trauma of them, the love that we experience with them, and also their own baseline humanity as existence, it becomes like red zone danger, and we can't kind of wade into that water at all. And that might be a very necessary protective measure for us. It really might be. And in the long scheme of things, I think that it hurts us when we think of folks as not, anyone as not human. I think it can be a really negative thing in our bodies that we carry for a very long time, and it's hard to disentangle from. And so in terms of the kind of idea of monstrous, like, and the way that it's laid out in the novel, you know, Gosar refers to themselves a lot as that. And you said, and in their immediate vicinity, they throw that word onto their siblings because they're in such a terrible situation. And sometimes the only way that you can survive something like that is by being like, this is my fault. Or like, this is the part of it that is in me that I can internalize. You know, it becomes quite difficult to fully ascribe that onto your caretakers when there's such... when you need them, and when there's such necessity from them, and also when there is incredible abuse that's happening in that novel that is making those characters devalue themselves, you know, to a point of just extreme lack of self-worth. And so when I was crafting it, it was like, this is what Koser is feeling. And it's completely untrue. You know, what you're getting is like, okay, you have a kid who's going through a lot of intense trauma, and this is their narrative of themselves, but that's not actually who they are. You know, like they're having very real life responses to the terrible, intense environment around them. What's interesting is it kind of really is, it's just really up for interpretation. You know, what are these words that we're using, and are they fair? Are they not? And how are the ways that we've internalized the, you know, some of the monstrosities that we've witnessed in our life, and then like ascribe back onto ourselves in really harmful and really painful ways.
You are saying humanity and, you know, not human. And it reminds me that, you know, this uncle puts these children in an apartment building with a bunch of abandoned animals, birds and hamsters and rabbits. I'm wondering if you could characterize that impulse to bring these animals into the space. Are you kind of doing this novelistic comparison, this non-human to human comparison here? Or what was that impulse?
Yeah, I mean, the impulse was the kind, it really kind of came from the kind of idea of like, yeah, like look at all the ways in which what is overlooked. Like what is neglect, and what is neglect when you kind of can't really say anything, you know? And so in the case of Koser and the siblings, that neglect is directly related to the fact that they are children and can't say anything, you know, like they just like quite, and they're in such a precarious position. They can't say anything. These animals can't say anything, you know, and they don't have jurisdiction over them, their own lives. And yet they take freedom in the ways that they can, you know. The birds escape, and then they're like in the hallway, and they're kind of like creating this kind of hallway environment and atmosphere, and they're like living in this space, you know. But they're taking the liberty that they can within the system that they're caged in. You know, even the characters of Mimu and Auntie, you know, they also like they're in a system. They're very vulnerable. They don't have, and you know, even as kids, these kids recognize it. They recognize that they have more, in certain moments, have more access than the adults in their life because of their particular vulnerability. And all of those things, it's like when you can't speak about something, when you do not have the power to say this thing is not okay, what is the kind of neglect and the kind of abuse that can just proliferate from that space? And I think that there's a real kind of conversation that's happening in that house around everyone who kind of needs to be there, everyone and everything that kind of needs to be there.
That was Fatima Oscar, and their debut novel, When We Were Sisters, is out now from One World, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Look for more information about Fatima at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. Our artwork was designed for The Right Question by Molly Russell, and our music was written and recorded by John Floridis. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.